industry of any size. As long as there are human beings brought together for a common cause, leaders can choose to set the kind of culture they want. There is no upheaval or layoffs required for this. The talent pool does not need to be replaced. Those who don't embrace the values that define the culture may feel the cortisol in their bodies, telling them that they don't belong. Feeling the anxiety of being an outsider in the group, they may decide to find a place in which they are a better fit. The others, in contrast, will feel safe among their colleagues. They will feel like they have found a home. All that is required to accomplish this is for the leaders of a company to make the decision to do it. They have the power to create an environment in which people will naturally thrive and advance the good of the organization itself. Once the culture and the values are clearly defined, it becomes the responsibility of all those who belong, whether in formal positions of leadership or not, to act like leaders, to work to uphold the values and keep the circle of safety strong. Chapter 8: Why We Have Leaders. The hunters returned victorious. After a long day of tracking, a journey that took them miles from home, they were able to kill a deer big enough to feed everyone. Upon their return, many of their tribe rushed in to congratulate them and take the carcass to be prepared for the feast that would soon come. But there was a problem. Everyone was hungry and anxious to eat. When living in populations of about 100 to 150 people, as our ancestors did, clearly the whole tribe couldn't just rush in and grab food. Chaos would ensue. So who gets to eat first? Fortunately, the social chemicals inside our bodies direct our behavior to help solve this problem too. Companies and organizations are our modern tribes. Like any tribe, they have traditions and symbols and language. The culture of a company is like the culture of any tribe. Some have strong cultures and some have weak cultures. We feel like we belong to some more than others, that we more easily click with the people in one culture over another. And, like all tribes, some have strong leaders and some have weak leaders. But they all have leaders. Almost everything about us is purpose-built to help increase our opportunities for survival and success, and our need for leaders is no exception. An anthropological look at the history of leadership, why we have leaders in the first place, reveals some objective standards as to what makes a good leader and what makes a bad one. And, like some of the other systems in our bodies that influence our behavior, our need for hierarchies is linked to food and protection. As much as we all like the idea of being equal, the fact is we are not and never will be. And for good reason. Without some rules of order, when the hunters brought back the fresh kill to the tribe, everyone would rush in to eat. There would be a lot of pushing and shoving. Invariably, the ones who are lucky enough to be built like linebackers would get to eat first, whereas the artist of the family would consistently get shoved aside or hurt. This is not a very good system if Mother Nature is trying to keep the species alive. The ones who are shoved aside would likely be less willing to trust or work closely with someone who had punched them earlier that afternoon. So to solve the problem, we evolved into hierarchical animals. When we perceived someone as dominant to us, instead of fighting them for food, we voluntarily stepped back and allowed them to eat first. And thanks to serotonin, those to whom we showed deference would feel their status rise in the group, letting them know that they were the alphas. That's how hierarchy works. Among other advantages, like getting first choice of mate, the alphas were also offered first choice of meat. After they were done eating, the rest of the tribe would get to eat. And though the others would not get the best cuts of meat, they would get to eat eventually, and they wouldn't have to get an elbow in the face when they did. This is a system much more conducive to cooperation. To this day, we are perfectly comfortable with the alphas in our society, assessed in terms relative to our modern community, not just physical strength, getting certain advantages. We have no problem with someone who outranks us at work making more money than us, getting a bigger office, or a better parking space. We have no issue with celebrities getting a table in the hard-to-get-into restaurant. We have no problem with the rich and famous getting the best-looking guy or girl on their arm. In fact, we're so comfortable with the alphas getting preferential treatment, on some occasions, some of us may even get upset or offended if they didn't. Many of us would find it strange or even disrespectful if the President of the United States had to carry his own luggage. Regardless of party, we would be uncomfortable with the notion simply because he is the leader of our political hierarchy. He's the president, after all. He shouldn't have to do that. Some of us would even volunteer to carry the luggage. It's an honor in society to do things to help our leaders. And perhaps at a later date, if they remember or recognize us, they may even throw us a bone while someone else is watching. And if they did, we would feel a burst of serotonin and feel our status and confidence rise as a result. It is because of the advantages an alpha gets in a society that we are always trying to improve our own place in the pecking order. We primp and puff ourselves up when we go to bars with the hope that others will see us as healthy and attractive, worthy of keeping our genes in the gene pool. We like to talk about our accomplishments, hang our diplomas on our walls, and put our trophies on a shelf for all to see what we've achieved. Our goal is to be seen as smart and strong and worthy of the advantages of an alpha, worthy of the respect of others, all to raise our status in our community. This is the whole idea behind status symbols, which, because of serotonin, actually do boost our sense of status. There is a reason that the logos are on the outside of most expensive items. We want people to see the red stripe down the side of our Prada sunglasses, the double C's in our Chanel bags, or the shiny Mercedes emblem stuck on the front of our cars. In our capitalist society, conspicuous displays of wealth may indicate to others that we are doing well. A symbol of our strength and capacity, they earn us respect and boost our position in the hierarchy. It's no wonder some of us try to fake our status. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. Though a good fake may trick others into thinking we are more successful than we are, this is biology, and we can't fool ourselves. A 2010 study by three psychology scientists, Francesca Gino of Chapel Hill, Michael Norton of Harvard Business School, and Dan Ariely of Duke, showed that people who wear phony couture clothing actually don't feel the same burst of pride or status as those who wear the real thing. Faking it, it turns out, makes us feel phony, as if we're cheating. Status is biological. We have to earn it to feel it. The same study also concluded that those who attempted to cheat their biology were actually more inclined to cheat in other aspects of their lives as well. Even though we can indeed raise our status with material goods, the feeling doesn't last. There's no social relationship associated with that burst of serotonin. Again, the selfless chemicals are trying to help us strengthen our communities and social bonds. To find a lasting sense of pride, there must be a mentor, parent, boss, coach, leader relationship to back it up. Leadership status is not just reserved for people. We also offer it to the tribes themselves. Just as we work to raise our individual status within our tribes, companies are constantly trying to raise their status in their respective industries. They tell us how many J.D. Powers awards they have won. They report their ranking in the Fortune 1000 list. Smaller companies are quick to share if they're an Inc. 5000 company, a ranking of the fastest growing small businesses. The reason we love rankings is because we're hierarchical animals, and there are perks to being higher in the pecking order. However, all the advantages of leadership do not come for free. In fact, they come at quite a steep price. And it is this part of the equation that is too often forgotten in many of our organizations today. It is true that the alpha may really be stronger than the rest of us. We know that all our respect and adoration really does boost their self-confidence. That's good. Because when the group faces a threat from the outside, we expect the leader, who really is stronger, better fed, and oozing with confidence from all that serotonin in their body, to be the first one to rush toward the danger to protect the rest of us. The cost of leadership, explains Lieutenant General George Flynn of the United States Marine Corps, is self-interest. That's also the reason we give our alphas first choice of mate. If they die early while trying to defend us, we want to make sure all those strong genes stay in our gene pool. The group isn't stupid. We wouldn't give them all those perks for nothing. That wouldn't be fair. This is the reason we are so offended by the exorbitant and disproportionate compensations of some of the leaders of investment banks. It has nothing to do with the numbers. It has to do with the social contract, deeply ingrained in what it means to be human. If our leaders are to enjoy the trappings of their position in the hierarchy, then we expect them to offer us protection. The problem is, for many of the overpaid leaders, we know that they took the money and perks and didn't offer protection to their people. In some cases, they even sacrificed their people to protect or boost their own interests. This is what so viscerally offends us. We only accuse them of greed and excess when we feel they have violated the very definition of what it means to be a leader. Few would be offended if it were decided to give Nelson Mandela a $150 million bonus. If it were announced that Mother Teresa was awarded $250 million at the end of the fiscal year, few, if anyone, would make a stink about it. We know that they upheld their side of the social contract. They were willing to make sacrifices for the good of those who chose to follow them. They considered the well-being of others before themselves and sometimes suffered as a result. And in those cases, we are perfectly happy with our leaders receiving all the perks we feel they have earned. The same goes for companies. They earn their reputations by being willing to do the right thing for their people and their customers or clients. That reputation suffers when they break the social contract of leadership. If we consider how we treat celebrities or the wealthy in our materialistic, reality TV-saturated society, all this science seems to make sense. Some people who inherit money, coerce the system, or gain celebrity thanks to the modern media system are afforded certain perks simply because they would appear to have a higher status than ours. But fame is supposed to be a byproduct of alpha status, not a way to achieve it. The same is true for financial wealth. It's supposed to be the byproduct of accomplishment, not the standard for leadership status alone. Unless someone is willing to make personal sacrifices for the good of others to earn their place in the hierarchy, they aren't really alpha material. Simply acting the part is not enough. Just like the phony couture wearer, they may feel insecure about their position or work extra hard to compensate or try to prove to the public and themselves that they are deserving of all the advantages they get. This is one of the reasons a publicist may recommend to a celebrity client that they get involved in charitable work. In our modern world, that's the game. It is important to uphold the appearance of maintaining that deeply seated social contract, that our alphas are supposed to serve us. And though there are definite benefits to a celebrity using their bully pulpits to bring attention to a cause or plight, if they really cared, they wouldn't need to publicize every time they did something. Perhaps one of the sacrifices they could make is the spotlight. The same is true for politicians during election cycles. It's fun to watch the politicians who announce that if elected, they will do all these good things because they care about us. And if they lose their election, many go on to do none of those things. The rank of office is not what makes someone a leader. Leadership is the choice to serve others with or without any formal rank. There are people with authority who are not leaders, and there are people at the bottom rungs of an organization who most certainly are leaders. It's okay for leaders to enjoy all the perks afforded to them. However, they must be willing to give up those perks when it matters. Leaders are the ones willing to look out for those to the left of them and those to the right of them. They are often willing to sacrifice their own comfort for ours, even when they disagree with us. Trust is not simply a matter of shared opinions. Trust is a biological reaction to the belief that someone has our well-being at heart. Leaders are the ones who are willing to give up something of their own for us. Their time, their energy, their money, maybe even the food off their plate. When it matters, leaders choose to eat last. By the objective standards of leadership, those who aim to raise their own status simply so they can enjoy the perks themselves, without fulfilling their responsibility as leaders, are, plain and simple, weak leaders. Though they may achieve alpha status and rise in the ranks, though they may possess talents and strengths that could earmark them for alpha status, they only become leaders when they accept the responsibility to protect those in their care. If they choose to sacrifice those in their tribe for personal gain, however, they will often struggle to hold onto their position once they've got it. Again, the group is not stupid. The people always have the power. The leaders of organizations who rise through the ranks not because they want it, but because the tribe keeps offering them higher status out of gratitude for their willingness to sacrifice, are the true leaders worthy of our trust and loyalty. All leaders, even the good ones, can sometimes lose their way and become selfish and power-hungry, however. Intoxicated by the chemicals, they can sometimes forget that their responsibility as a leader is to their people. Sometimes, these leaders are able to regain their footing. But if they don't, we have little choice but to look past them, lament what they have become, wait for them to move on, and look to someone else to lead us. What makes a good leader is that they eschew the spotlight in favor of spending time and energy to do what they need to do to support and protect their people. And when we feel the circle of safety around us, we offer our blood and sweat and tears and do everything we can to see our leaders' vision come to life. The only thing our leaders ever need to do is remember whom they serve, and it will be an honor and a pleasure to serve them back. The Ceramic Cup. I heard a story about a former Undersecretary of Defense who gave a speech at a large conference. He took his place on the stage and began talking, sharing his prepared remarks with the audience. He paused to take a sip of coffee from the styrofoam cup he brought on stage with him. He took another sip, looked down at the cup, and smiled. "You know," he said, interrupting his own speech, "I spoke here last year. I presented at this same conference on this same stage. But last year, I was still an undersecretary," he said. "I flew here in business class, and when I landed, there was someone waiting for me at the airport to take me to my hotel. Upon arriving at my hotel," he continued, "there was someone else waiting for me. They had already checked me into the hotel, so they handed me my key and escorted me up to my room. The next morning, when I came down, again, there was someone waiting for me in the lobby to drive me to this same venue that we're in today. I was taken through a back entrance, shown to the green room, and handed a cup of coffee in a beautiful ceramic cup. But this year, as I stand here to speak to you, I am no longer the undersecretary," he continued. "I flew here coach class, and when I arrived at the airport yesterday, there was no one there to meet me. I took a taxi to the hotel, and when I got there, I checked myself in and went by myself to my room. This morning, I came down to the lobby, caught another taxi to come here. I came in the front door and found my way backstage. Once there, I asked one of the techs if there was some coffee. He pointed to a coffee machine on a table against the wall, and so I walked over and poured myself a cup of coffee into this here styrofoam cup," he said as he raised the cup to show the audience. "It occurs to me," he continued, "the ceramic cup they gave me last year, it was never meant for me at all. It was meant for the position I held. I deserve a styrofoam cup." "This is the most important lesson I can impart to all of you," he offered. "All the perks, all the benefits and advantages you may get for the rank or position you hold, they aren't meant for you. They're meant for the role you fill. And when you leave your role, which eventually you will, they will give the ceramic cup to the person who replaces you, because you only ever deserved a styrofoam cup." Eating last is repaid with loyalty and hard work. When the stock market crashed in 2008, like so many other companies, Barry Waymiller got hit pretty hard. The old-fashioned American manufacturing company that Chapman was transforming saw an almost immediate 30% drop in machine orders. The company makes large industrial machinery, the kinds of machines a large packaged goods company would buy to make the cardboard boxes for their products. The machines that Barry Waymiller makes are among the first things to get cut when a company slashes its capital expenditures budget in hard times and opts instead to make do with their aging machines. Chapman and his team were faced with a blunt truth. They were no longer able to afford to keep all their employees. They simply didn't have the work or the revenue to justify keeping everyone on board. And so, for the first time in a long time, the subject of layoffs was raised. For many companies, the option would seem obvious, even if unsavory. But Chapman refused to sack people simply because the company was having a hard year. More and more, he came to see his company as a family, as a group of people to serve and keep safe, and not just as a labor force to be used to serve the company. "We would never dream of getting rid of one of our children in hard times," he says. "If anything, the whole family would come together, maybe suffer together, but ultimately work through the hard times together." And so, instead of layoffs, the company implemented a mandatory furlough program. Every employee, from CEO to secretary, would have to take 4 weeks of unpaid time off. They could take the weeks off whenever they wanted, and the weeks did not have to be taken consecutively. But it was how Chapman announced the program that proved his leadership bona fides. "It is better that we all suffer a little," he told his people, "so that none of us has to suffer a lot." The protection Chapman offered his people had a massive impact. Unlike in a company that announces layoffs, sending everyone into self-preservation mode, At Barry Waymiller, the people spontaneously and completely on their own set out to do more for each other. Those who could afford more time off traded with those who could afford it less. Though they were under no obligation to do so, they took off more unpaid time than required just to help someone else out. The overwhelming feeling across the company was one of gratitude for the security they had been given. I suspect in other companies that faced hard times, most of the people would also rather lose a month's pay than lose their job. As soon as things started to pick up again, the furlough program was done away with, and the 401k contributions that the company had stopped paying in the tough times were not only restored, but were backpaid to when the tough times began. The result was astounding. The leaders fulfilled their anthropological obligation of an alpha to protect the tribe, and in return, the people repaid that protection with an intense loyalty, wanting to do whatever they can to help the company. Few from Barry Waymiller ever leave just for more money. To human beings, the safety a strong tribe provides its members makes the tribe stronger and better equipped to deal with the dangers and uncertainty of the outside world. The reason good leaders do well in hard times is obvious. Their people willingly commit their blood, sweat, and tears to see the tribe, the company, advance and grow strong. They do so not because they have to, but because they want to. And as a result, the stronger tribe, the stronger company, is able to guarantee a greater sense of safety and protection to even more people for even longer. Fear, in contrast, can hurt the very innovation and progress so many leaders of companies claim they are trying to advance with every reorg. EDSO Revisited. Each of the feel-good chemicals is essential for our survival as individuals and as populations. They play a role based on our needs and the environments in which we work. Our ability to work hard and muscle through hard labor is thanks to endorphins. Our ability to set goals, focus, and get things done comes from the incentivizing power of dopamine. It feels good to make progress, and so we do. Serotonin is responsible for the pride we feel when those we care for achieve great things, or when we make proud the people who take care of us. Serotonin helps to ensure we look out for those who follow us and do right by those who lead us. And the mysterious power of oxytocin helps us form bonds of love and trust. It helps us form relationships so strong we can make decisions with complete confidence that those who care about us will stand by our side. We know that if we need help or support, the people who care about us will be there for us no matter what. Oxytocin keeps us healthy. It opens our minds. It biologically makes us better problem solvers. Without oxytocin, we would only ever make short-term progress. Leaps of greatness require the combined problem-solving ability of people who trust each other. Like all things human, it is not a perfect system. The chemicals do not fire in equal quantities and in strict allotments. They are sometimes released together, and they are released in varying amounts. What's more, we can short-circuit the system to release the chemicals for the wrong reasons. The selfish chemicals, endorphins and dopamine, give us short-term rewards to which we can, under the right conditions, become addicted. The selfless chemicals, serotonin and oxytocin, take time to build up in our systems before we can enjoy their full benefits. Though we may enjoy the thrill of reaching a goal or winning a race, that feeling won't last. To get more of that feeling, we need to win another race and reach a more distant goal. The bonds of love and trust and friendship take time to feel. We cannot motivate others, per se. Our motivation is determined by the chemical incentives inside every one of us. Any motivation we have is a function of our desire to repeat behaviors that make us feel good or avoid stress or pain. The only thing we can do is create environments in which the right chemicals are released for the right reasons. And if we get the environment right, if we create organizational cultures that work to the natural inclinations of the human animal, the result will be an entire group of self-motivated people. The goal for any leader of any organization is to find the balance. When dopamine is the primary driver, we may achieve a lot, but we will feel lonely and unfulfilled no matter how rich or powerful we get. We live lives of quick hits in search of the next rush. Dopamine simply does not help us create things that are built to last. When we live in a hippie commune, the oxytocin gushing, but without any specific measurable goals or ambition, we can deny ourselves those intense feelings of accomplishment. No matter how loved we may feel still feel like failures. The goal, again, is balance. When the system is in balance, however, we seem to gain an almost supernatural ability. Courage, inspiration, foresight, creativity, and empathy, to name a few. And when those things all come to bear, the results and the feelings that go with them are simply remarkable. Part 3. Reality. Chapter 9. The Courage to Do the Right Thing. Know when to break the rules. "How many souls on board?" the air traffic controller asked. As if we were still traversing the globe in wooden ships with tall masts, the archaic terminology referring to the number of people aboard the vessel is a standard question asked when an aircraft declares an in-flight emergency. 126 souls, replied the pilot. The Florida-bound flight was somewhere over Maryland at an altitude of 36,000 feet, traveling at about 560 miles per hour, when smoke started to pour into the cockpit. Smoke on board an aircraft is one of the most terrifying emergencies a pilot will ever face. They don't always know the cause of the smoke. They don't know if there is a fire. They don't know if the emergency is contained or if it's going to spread, and spread out of control quickly. The smoke itself can make seeing or breathing difficult, and it is sure to cause panic among the passengers. No matter how you look at it, it's bad. "Center, KH-209, the pilot radioed when he realized the problem. "KH-209, go ahead," replied the controller monitoring the airspace. "KH-209, I need to descend immediately. I can't maintain altitude," was the abrupt call from the pilot. But there was a problem. There was another flight also flying to Florida, 2,000 feet directly below the troubled aircraft. The FAA rules are simple enough. No two aircraft flying en route may pass each other any closer than 1,000 feet above or below, or 5 miles around each other. The rules are there for good reason. Traveling at 3/4 the speed of sound, it becomes very difficult to maneuver aircraft without creating a serious risk of collision. To make matters worse, the two planes were flying in a narrow route toward their destination. Because of a military exercise that was going on in the area, the airspace was restricted to a narrow band, much like the lane of a highway. And though there were other lanes on this highway, there was other traffic in them at the time. The air traffic controller replied to the pilot's request to descend immediately. "KH-209, turn 15 degrees right and descend." Not only had the air traffic controller ordered the distressed airplane to enter restricted airspace, but telling the pilot to descend would mean he would pass well within the 5-mile buffer of the plane flying beneath him. Modern airplanes are equipped with collision alarms that alert a pilot when another airplane flies within that 1,000-foot, 5-mile buffer. When the alarm sounds, knowing the limited time they have, pilots are trained to react to what could be an impending disaster. The proximity by which these two planes would pass each other, 2 miles to be exact, would surely set off the collision alarm of the flight traveling at 34,000 feet, and that would create another problem. But this was a very experienced air traffic controller sitting at the console that day. He was fully aware of all the aircraft in the area. What's more, he was very aware of all the rules and restrictions. He radioed the pilot of the other aircraft and spoke in very clear, plain English. "AG-1446, there is an airplane flying above you. He has declared an emergency. He's going to descend through your altitude at approximately 2 miles off your right front. He needs to descend immediately." This same message would be repeated again as the troubled vessel passed through the airspace of another 3 aircraft as it made its way down. On that clear day over Maryland, 126 souls were saved because one very experienced air traffic controller decided to break the rules. Keeping people alive was more important than maintaining boundaries. There were over 9.8 million scheduled domestic and passenger flights on U.S. Airlines in 2012. That's nearly 26,800 flights per day. The numbers are staggering. These numbers don't even include the unscheduled cargo and foreign flights that crisscross America every year. More than 815 million passengers each year entrust their lives to the pilots who transport us, the mechanics who ensure the aircraft are airworthy, and the FAA, which develops the regulations to ensure everything runs as safely as possible. And then there are the air traffic controllers. We trust these relatively few people to obey the rules to ensure that all those aircraft are kept moving safely across the skies. But in the case of Flight KH-209, the controller broke the rules. He disobeyed the clear line set to ensure our safety. And that's what trust is. We don't just trust people to obey the rules, we also trust that they know when to break them. The rules are there for normal operations. The rules are designed to avoid danger and help ensure that things go smoothly. And though there are guidelines for how to deal with emergencies, at the end of the day, we trust the expertise of a special few people to know when to break the rules. Organizations that offer people an opportunity to fully commit work tirelessly to train their people. This goes beyond the occasional class on how to write a better PowerPoint or be a more effective presenter. These organizations offer endless opportunities for self-improvement. The more training they offer us, the more we learn. The more experienced and confident we become, the more the organization is willing to give us greater and greater responsibility. And ultimately, the organization, our management, and our colleagues is willing to trust us to know when to break the rules. We cannot trust rules or technology. We can rely on them for sure, but trust them? No. Trust is a very special human experience, produced by the chemical oxytocin in response to acts performed on our behalf that serve our safety and protection. True trust can only exist among people, and we can only trust others when we know that they are actively and consciously concerned about us. A technology, no matter how sophisticated, doesn't care about us at all. It simply reacts to a set of variables. And the rulebook, no matter how comprehensive, cannot consider every eventuality. Imagine if every time we had a fight with a loved one, they reacted to a set of variables or deferred to the rulebook for advice. How long do you think that relationship would last? This is the reason we find bureaucrats infuriating. They simply default to the rules with no consideration for the people those rules were designed to help or protect. In other words, they don't care. There is no algorithm for a successful relationship between people or with companies. The true social benefit of trust must be reciprocal. One-way trust is not beneficial to the individual or the group. What good is a company in which management trusts labor, but labor doesn't trust the management? It is hardly a strong marriage in which the wife trusts the husband, but the husband doesn't trust the wife. It's all fine and good for a leader to expect the people to trust them, but if the leader doesn't trust the people, the system will fail. For trust to serve the individuals and the group, it must be shared. The responsibility of leaders is to teach their people the rules, train them to gain competency, and build their confidence. At that point, leadership must step back and trust that their people know what they are doing and will do what needs to be done. In weak organizations, without oversight, too many people will break the rules for personal gain. That's what makes these organizations weak. In strong organizations, people will break the rules because it is the right thing to do for others. Think about it. Would you feel comfortable watching your family board a plane, knowing there was a qualified pilot or controller who will do everything by the book no matter what? Would you let your family get on a plane, knowing that the pilot or air traffic controller cared only about what they need to do to get their next bonus? Or would you rather watch your family board a plane, knowing there were confident pilots and controllers with lots of experience who will know what rules to break if something should go wrong, possibly putting their bonus at risk as a result? The answer is so plainly obvious. We don't trust rules. We trust people. The responsibility of a leader is to provide cover from above for their people who are working below. When the people feel that they have control to do what's right, even if it sometimes means breaking the rules, then they will more likely do the right thing. Courage comes from above. Our confidence to do what's right is determined by how trusted we feel by our leaders. If good people are asked to work in a bad culture, one in which leaders do not relinquish control, then the odds of something bad happening go up. People will be more concerned about following the rules out of fear of getting in trouble or losing their jobs than doing what needs to be done. And when that happens, souls will be lost. Chapter 10. The Snowmobile in the Desert. Let's face it. We're good. We're really good. I mean, we're the best thing that ever lived. This is not the ramblings of an egomaniac. Just look at the world around us. Other animals just go about their days, looking for food, procreating, and operating on instinct. But not us. We do so much more than operate to survive or grow our population, though we will do that as well. We invent, build, and achieve things unachievable by any other species on the planet. Gazelles didn't build the pyramids. We did. Gorillas didn't figure out the combustion engine. We did. And it's all because of our remarkable neocortex, the part of our brain that separates us from the other mammals. It is our neocortex that gives us the ability to think rationally and critically about the world and solve complex problems. It is because of our neocortex that we can speak and communicate in a way vastly more sophisticated than any other species on the planet. It is this ability that allows us, among many other things, to pass on our lessons to others so that they don't need to relearn everything we've learned. Each generation is able to build on the lessons of the previous generations so that we can make real progress in the world. This is what it means to be human. We are achievement machines. However, as great as our neocortex is at helping us get things done, it is our primitive limbic brain that controls our feelings, our ability to trust, our ability to cooperate, our ability to socialize and build strong communities. It is our limbic brain that feeds the gut reactions and gut decisions that drive our behavior. It gives us the ability to form strong emotional bonds with others, and these strong social bonds allow us to work together to do all the things our Homo sapien neocortices can dream up. If we weren't able to trust each other and work together, no matter how smart we were, we would die young and alone. We would never feel the joy of being in relationships, have the feeling of being in a circle of people with whom we share the same values and beliefs, or the intense feeling of goodness that comes from doing something for someone else. As much as we like to think that it is our smarts that get us ahead, it is not everything. Our intelligence gives us ideas and instructions, but it is our ability to cooperate that actually helps us get those things done. Nothing of real value on this earth was ever built by one person without the help of others. There are few accomplishments, companies, or technologies that were built by one person without the help or support of anyone else. It is clear that the more others want to help us, the more we can achieve. And it is our ability to get things done that has produced one of the greatest paradoxes of the modern era. In our pursuit to advance, we have, without intending to, built a world that is making it harder and harder for us to cooperate. The symptoms of this cruel irony are easy to feel in the developed world. Feelings of isolation and high stress have fueled industries that are profiting from our search for happiness. Self-help books, courses, and any number of pharmaceuticals make up multi-billion-dollar industries designed to help us find that elusive happiness, or, at the very least, to reduce our stress. In only a few decades, the self-help business alone has grown to $11 billion. The biggest thing the self-help industry seems to have helped is itself. Our search for happiness and connection has also led us to seek professional advice. In the 1950s, few of us went to weekly sessions with a therapist. Today, in the U.S., according to the Hoover Institute, there are 77,000 clinical psychologists, 192,000 clinical social workers, 105,000 mental health counselors, 50,000 marriage and family therapists, 17,000 nurse psychotherapists, and 30,000 life coaches. The only reason the field continues to grow is because of increasing demand. The more we try to make ourselves feel better, the worse we seem to feel. That only a minority of employees feel fulfilled and truly happy at work is our own doing. We have built systems and constructed organizations that force the human animal to work in environments in which it does not work best. With an excess of dopamine to drive us and cortisol flowing when we don't need it, we have actually short-circuited our system to do the opposite, to encourage us to look out for ourselves first and be suspicious of others. If the human being is a snowmobile, this means we are designed to operate in very specific conditions. Take the machine designed for one kind of condition, snow, and put it in another condition, the desert, for example, and it won't operate as well. Sure, the snowmobile will go, it just won't go as easily or as well as if it were in the right conditions. This is what has happened in many of our modern organizations. And when progress is slow or innovation is lacking, leaders tinker with the machine. They hire and fire in hopes of getting the right mix. They develop new kinds of incentives to encourage the machine to work harder. With an incentivizing cocktail of dopamine, the machines will indeed work harder and maybe even go a little faster in the desert. But the friction is great. What too many leaders of organizations fail to appreciate is that it's not the people that are the problem. The people are fine. Rather, it's the environment in which the people operate that is the problem. Get that right, and things just go. To a social animal, trust is like lubrication. It reduces friction and creates conditions much more conducive to performance. just like putting the snowmobile back in the snow. Do that, and even an underpowered snowmobile will run circles around the most powerful snowmobile in the wrong conditions. It's not how smart the people in the organization are. It's how well they work together that is the true indicator of future success or the ability to manage through struggle. Trust and commitment are feelings that we get from the release of chemical incentives deep in our limbic brain. And as such, they are inherently hard to measure. Just as we can't simply tell someone to be happy and expect them to be happy, we can't just tell someone to trust us or to commit to something and expect they will. There are all sorts of things we need to do first before someone will feel any sense of loyalty or devotion. There are some basic tenets that all leaders of organizations must obey to build deep trust and commitment among the people who work for them. And in a very undopamine way, it will take time, energy, and the will of people for these things to work. All this begs the question, how did we get ourselves into the desert in the first place? The Path We Chose. Part 4. How We Got Here. Chapter 11. The Boom Before the Bust. Times were good, really good. Everyone was making money, and everyone was spending it. The result was unprecedented growth. In fact, the total wealth in the country more than doubled in fewer than 10 years. There were new technologies, and a new kind of media that allowed news and ideas to spread like never before. These were unprecedented times indeed. This was not the 1980s or the 1990s. This was the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. The period after World War I was the time when America first truly became a consumer society. For the first time in years, Americans were relatively wealthy, and with the wealth came good times. With all that disposable income, they were able to buy luxuries and new technologies, all the new inventions that could improve the quality of life. Electric refrigerators, telephones, cars, and movies all saw their introduction and rise in popularity during the 1920s. And let's not forget about new forms of media that were introduced. In 1920, there was one commercial radio station in the United States, KDKA out of Pittsburgh. 3 years later, there were over 500 stations across the country, and at the end of the decade, there were more than 12 million households with radios. This new national media allowed for news to be broadcast like never before. It also allowed for national advertising to be broadcast in a way that was previously impossible. Combined with the introduction of chain stores, the popularity of radio meant that people on one coast could now buy the same things as people on the other coast. And with the arrival of the movies, more and more media focused on the lives of movie stars and sports heroes. We dreamed of living glamorous lives like theirs. With national attention, celebrity was no longer a byproduct of success. It became a thing to achieve itself. Fame became a new way to achieve alpha status. It was a time of aspiration. Thanks to all these new technologies and modern conveniences, the period also gave rise to entirely new industries. Just like the internet created a need for IT consultants, the automobile created a need for gas stations, for example. It all sounds eerily reminiscent of our modern times. New technologies, new media, new industries, an obsession with the lives of celebrities, the increase of wealth and consumerism, and most significant, thanks to all that excess, a preponderance of waste. Then something happened. It all suddenly stopped. As much as people try to beat the laws of nature, there's always a correction. Nature abhors imbalance. Nothing can grow forever. And so despite the expectation of never-ending good times, on October 29th, 1929, it all came to a sudden and abrupt halt. Black Tuesday, as the crash was called, was a huge correction in the stock market. The weight of the imbalance and overvaluations had to, at some point, right itself and find balance again. Though corrections are not uncommon, in this case, the imbalance was so extreme that the correction was significant enough to start the Great Depression. A period marked by a loss of nearly 90% of the stock market's value and unemployment rates that left as many as a quarter of the country jobless. Unlike their parents, those born during most of the 1920s were too young to actually enjoy the 1920s. They were raised in one of the most austere times in American history. And, as our anthropology dictates, with resources scarce, the generation learned to work together and help each other make ends meet. Waste and excess just weren't an option anymore. The Depression lasted for over a decade and didn't end until nearly 1942. It was the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that forced America into World War II and pulled it out of the Depression. The generation that grew up during some of the worst economic times in the country came of age just in time to be drafted and shipped off to do battle with Hitler's armies. The entire country went straight from the Great Depression into a Great War. By the time America entered World War II, the population of the United States was about 133 million, of which about 16 million marched off to war. That's about 12% of the population. Today, America's population is more than 315 million, and less than 1% serve in the military. That includes active duty, civilian, guard, and reserve forces. Of course, these are different times, and we're not involved in a world war, a war in which we would bear any burden or pay any price to protect what we believed in. During World War II, given the sheer volume of people who put on a uniform, nearly everyone knew someone who served in the military. Many parents watched their own sons march off to battle. Today, simply because most of us aren't friends with someone in the military, we have trouble understanding how people can maintain such a deep sense of selfless service. Unlike today's conflicts, World War II wasn't a war that happened at a distance. It wasn't viewed on television or on a computer screen. It was a war that touched the lives of most of the country. The entire nation was involved in the war effort. According to The War, the seminal World War II documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, 24 million people relocated to take defense jobs, and millions of women, African Americans, and Latinos found unprecedented opportunities in the workforce. Many others bought war bonds to help finance the war. Buying war bonds gave those who couldn't offer physical support the feeling that they too were a part of the effort. And for those who couldn't afford the war bonds, they contributed by planting victory gardens, growing fruit and vegetables to help reduce the burden of rationing. This is one of the reasons we call this generation the greatest generation. It was defined not by excess and consumerism, but by hardship and service. This was not a time when the country sat back and complained, pointed fingers, and debated if we should or should not be at war. This was a time when the whole country came together. According to a poll published in the November 1942 issue of Life magazine, over 90% of the country believed that America should keep fighting in the war. This was a population that overwhelmingly supported the draft before the war and continued to believe that military training should be compulsory after the war. As a nation, we believed in service. And nearly everyone, in some way, shape, or form, sacrificed and served for the good of each other. Nearly all Americans felt a part of something bigger than themselves. When the war was finally won, the men who survived the battles returned home to parades and parties. The celebration wasn't just for those who had risked their lives on the front lines. Rather, it was for all who had participated and sacrificed in their own way. Almost everyone shared the feeling of accomplishment and sense of relief that came with the Allied victory. As well they should have. They had worked hard for that feeling. They earned it. With the war behind them and the economy booming, the men and women of the greatest generation, those raised during the Depression then sent off to war, felt that they had missed out on their youth. Many were even bitter. They felt that they had already spent so much of their lives sacrificing that they wanted to try to reclaim some of what they had lost. And so they got to work. The importance of hard work, the necessity of cooperation, and the value of loyalty, everything they knew about getting things done, defined how companies operated when this generation ran them. The 1950s were defined as an era of giving one's entire life to one company, and of one company expecting their people to work there for their entire lives. At the end of a long career, an employee would receive their proverbial gold watch, the ultimate symbol of gratitude for a life of service to the company. And it worked. For a while. The 800-pound boomer in the room. Every generation seems to confound or rebel against the generation before it. Each new generation embodies a set of values and beliefs molded by the events, experience, and technologies of their youth, which tend to be a little different from those of their parents. And when the populations grow at a steady pace, the push and pull between the generations, the impulse of a new generation to change everything, and the desire of an older generation to keep things the same, work like a system of checks and balances. It offers a natural tension that helps to ensure we don't break everything while also allowing us to make progress and change with the times. One point of view, or a single uncontested power, is rarely a good thing. Like the visionary and the operator inside a company, Democrats and Republicans in Congress, the Soviets and Uncle Sam in geopolitics, even mom and dad at home. The value of two opposing forces, the tension of push and pull, actually keeps things more stable. It's all about balance. But something happened at the end of the Second World War that upset the normal system of checks and balances. A break in the natural order that would quite literally, and quite by accident, set America on an entirely new course. Returning from war, people celebrated, and celebrated, and celebrated. And 9 months later, there began a period of population growth never seen before in the United States. The baby boom. In 1940, there were 2.6 million children born. In 1946, the number of children born was 3.4 million. There was a small boom at the end of World War I, but it was the massive spike and burst that began after World War II that tipped the balance. A disparity that was compounded by the relatively slow birth rate during the Depression and the war. The end of the boomer generation is typically regarded as 1964, the year the number of births dipped below 4 million for the first time in more than a decade. All told, the boomers added 76 million people to the population, a growth rate of nearly 40%, compared to a less than 25% increase between 1964 and 1984. And the dramatic change doesn't stop there. Unlike their parents, who were raised during a time of economic depression and war rations, the boomers were raised in times of rising affluence and prosperity. Starting at the end of the war, wealth and GDP in America did nothing but grow at a steady pace. This was a good thing for all those boomers. The parents who fought or sacrificed were now able to give their children a life completely opposite to their own. Whereas the greatest generation was defined by the needs to serve others, the boomer generation started on a path of taking for themselves. As our wealth and attitudes changed, we started to transform from a country that would fight to protect a way of life into a country that would fight to protect the way we prefer to live. Growing up under the protection of their newly wealthy parents, the first group of boomers became teenagers in the 1960s. And, like all good teenagers, they rebelled against their parents' push for them to work hard and devote themselves to a job or a company until they got that gold watch. They rejected the quiet suburbs and their parents' focus on material wealth. Leave It to Beaver was not their idea of the good life. Individualism, free love, and narcissism were. In 1960s America, however, the hippies who chose to live a life with less than they needed did so for the simple fact that as a country, we had more than we needed. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the greatest generation was perfect. In fact, they had some serious problems. At the same time that Americans were saving the world from the tyranny of Nazism, they were struggling with issues of racism and inequality. The American dream was the picture of harmony, as long as you were white, Christian, and male. Back in the U.S., women were still considered unqualified for public life or the executive suite. African Americans wouldn't be embraced as full citizens until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, nearly 20 years after the war had ended. And even then, it passed with nearly 30% of the Senate voting against it. When the boomers were young, it was they who forced the civil rights on an older generation bent on maintaining an unhealthy and unjust status quo. It was indeed the young boomers who demanded better pay for women and refused to blindly accept the injustices that prevailed in our society. They might have become the second greatest generation had they continued on that path, but that's not how it went. As the disproportionately large generation of boomers started aging, they changed course. And that's when our modern era problems started to arise. The maturing boomers, as a generation, started to operate in different ways, in more selfish ways. They now set out to protect the world with which they were most familiar, the world of rising wealth and affluence. By the 1970s, the older boomers were now graduating from college and starting to make their way into the workforce. In a decade marked by an unpopular war and the Watergate scandal, Richard Nixon seemed to offer a foreboding look at the generation he served. His own selfish ambitions drove decisions that were at best unethical and at worst illegal. The boomers witnessed events that only reinforced their early beliefs that government can't be trusted, we have to look out for ourselves, and we need to change the way things are done. Forget the status quo. The boomers aspired to self-realization. Having a spiritual guru was like going to the gym today. They learned to disco, they wore polyester, and they sealed their reputation as the generation that defined, as Tom Wolfe described in a 1976 issue of New York Magazine, the Me Decade. They became a group that seemed to be more concerned about their own happiness and well-being than the happiness or well-being of those around them. As the generation grew older and started to enter the workforce, making their own contribution to our economy, they brought all this self-centeredness and cynicism with them. Except, in this case, there were vastly fewer of the previous generation to balance the ideals of this new me-before-we generation. The late 70s also saw the introduction of new theories about how to conduct business. Shaken by the Vietnam War, a presidential scandal, an oil crisis, the rise of globalization, and near the end of the decade, a revolution in Iran that involved American lives, economic theories became more protectionist in nature. They tended to focus on how to safeguard our rising wealth rather than to share it or use it to support causes of national importance, like the war bonds of earlier generations. Service to others, as part of our national identity, was slowly being replaced by service to ourselves as a national priority. Throughout this time, America's household affluence continued to skyrocket. Gross domestic product grew from $3.87 trillion in 1965 to $4.7 trillion in 1970 to $6.52 trillion in 1980. That's 68% growth in 15 years. It looked like a steep slope up with barely a bump in the road. We were getting wealthier and wealthier, as individuals and as a country. Though the wealthiest Americans were getting wealthier at a disproportionately higher rate than the rest of the country, even the poorest Americans at least stayed the same or even rose by a small degree. The point is, no segment of the population got significantly poorer. With the 1970s coming to a close, Americans started to replace their bell-bottom jeans with members-only jackets and to rip up their shag carpeting. The baby boomers were finally coming of age. They started to work at more senior levels at companies and in government. The coddled boomers, the ones who didn't have to suffer much, the ones who grew up in a society that could afford for them to put themselves first, were now starting to take positions in which they could affect political, business, and economic theory en masse. It's worth noting that it was when the boomers arrived that relationships in Congress really started to suffer. Until the early 1990s, members of the opposing parties, while still prone to the same theatrics they are today, were able to sit down together with the goal of reaching a compromise. They may not have agreed, but they tried. And for the most part, they behaved with civility. Their children went to school together, and their families knew each other. They even socialized on weekends. And as a result, Congress functioned. The boomer generation would emerge bigger and more powerful than any opposing force that could help keep things in check. Without a balancing tension, the impulses and desires of one group would prove hard to restrain. Like the unchecked power of America after the fall of the Soviet Union. Like the dictator who overthrows his predecessor. Like legislation passed when one party has a supermajority in Congress. The boomers would start to impose their will on the world around them, surrounded only by outnumbered voices telling them they couldn't. By the 1980s and the 1990s, this shockwave, this pig in the python, as the baby boom is sometimes described because of its sheer size and force, this demographic bulge, able to remodel societies they passed through it, was fully in charge. Chapter 12. The Boomers All Grown Up. The 1980s were now upon us, and we were no longer a country trying to figure out how to rally a population to win a war. We were now trying to figure out how to capitalize on the amazing boom years in which we were living, the Roaring 80s. During this period, new economic theories were being proposed to protect the wealth the boomers were accumulating, a classic symptom of excess. Where the radio, automobile, and electric refrigerator were the must-have items of the 1920s, another new technology became all the rage in the 1980s. The IBM PC, MS-DOS, Apple's Macintosh, and Microsoft Windows all contributed to the rise and spread of the personal computer. A PC on every desk, as Bill Gates, the young founder of Microsoft, envisioned. We no longer needed to go to work to have power. We could have power alone at home, too. The individual could compete against the corporation. Even the new technologies of the day supported the desire for more individualism. We were also becoming more and more comfortable with products having shorter lifespans. Other inventions of the 1980s included the disposable camera and disposable contact lenses. Disposability, another symptom of our excess, was now an industry to be pioneered. We were actually looking for more things we could throw out. And there was one other thing we started to view as disposable. People. The day we embraced layoffs. August 5th, 1981, that's the date it became official. It's rare that we can point to an exact date when a business theory or idea becomes an accepted practice, but in the case of mass layoffs, we can. August 5, 1981 was the day President Ronald Reagan fired more than 11,000 air traffic controllers. Demanding more pay and a shorter work week, PATCO, the air traffic controllers union at the time, was embroiled in a vicious labor dispute with the Federal Aviation Administration. When the talks broke down, PATCO threatened to go on strike, ostensibly shutting down airports and causing the cancellation of thousands of flights during one of the busiest travel periods of the year. Such a strike is illegal according to the sometimes controversial Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. The act essentially prohibits any labor strike to cause unfair harm to those not involved in the dispute or to do any damage to any commerce that would negatively affect the general welfare. This is the reason police and emergency room nurses are forbidden to strike. The damage such a strike would cause is believed to outweigh any grievances over unfair pay or hours. Without an acceptable deal, and worse, without the ability to find common ground, on August 3rd, PATCO's members refused to go to work. Given the strike's impact on the country, President Reagan got personally involved, ordering the air traffic controllers back to work. Meanwhile, contingency plans were also put into place, with supervisors, who were not members of the union, a small group of controllers who had chosen not to strike, and military air traffic controllers enlisted to cover the losses. Though not a perfect solution, these temporary workers were able to keep the majority of flights going. The effect of the strikes was not as severe as expected. And so, on August 5th, 1981, President Reagan fired 11,359 air traffic controllers, nearly every controller working for the FAA at the time. And it didn't stop there. Reagan banned every one of the strikers from ever working for the FAA again for the rest of their lives, a ban that remained in effect until President Clinton lifted it in 1993. Many of the air traffic controllers who were fired that day were veterans, which is where they learned the trade, or civil servants who had worked hard to earn their middle-class incomes. Because of the ban, and the fact that their skills were hardly transferable to other industries, there's not a huge demand for air traffic controllers outside the FAA, many of them found themselves in poverty. This is not a story about whether Reagan should or should not have fired the air traffic controllers. This is not a story about labor disputes and the right of unions to stand up to management. This is a story of something quite diabolical. This is a story about the long-term repercussions when a leader sets a new tone about what is acceptable or unacceptable behavior inside an organization. In an attempt to alleviate one short-term strain on our country, President Reagan inadvertently created a new, longer-lasting one. By firing all the air traffic controllers, he sent a message to business leaders across the nation. He unwittingly blessed the swift and even aggressive decision to use mass layoffs to guard against a short-term economic disruption. Though I am certain Reagan never intended it as such, some eager CEOs interpreted his actions as permission for them to do the same. There was now a precedence for protecting commerce before protecting people. And so for the first time ever, the social conventions that had restrained many a CEO from doing something that many may have wished they could in the past were instantly gone. With the tacit approval from on high, the practice of laying off people in mass numbers to balance the books started to happen with greater frequency. Layoffs had existed before the 80s, but usually as a last resort and not an early option. We were now entering a time in which even meritocracy mattered less. How hard someone worked or how much they sacrificed or contributed to the company no longer necessarily translated into job stability. Now anyone could be laid off simply to help balance the books for the year. Careers ended to make the numbers work. Protecting the money as economic theory replaced protecting the people. Under such conditions, how can we ever feel safe at work? How can we ever feel committed to the jobs we have if the leaders of our companies aren't committed to us? The very concept of putting a number or a resource before a person flies directly in the face of the protection our anthropology says leaders are supposed to offer. It's like parents putting the care of their car before the care of their child. It can rip apart the very fabric of the family. Such a redefining of the modern leader wreaks the same havoc on relationships in our companies, or even our society, as it does in our families. Starting in earnest in the 1980s, public institutions and industries succumbed to this new economic perspective. The consumer products industry, the food industry, The media, banking, Wall Street, even the Congress of the United States have all, to varying degrees, abandoned the people they exist to serve in favor of more selfish priorities. Those in positions of authority and responsibility more readily allow outside constituents, sometimes unengaged constituents, to influence their decisions and actions. By agreeing to offer a supply to meet the demands of outsiders, these leaders who act like followers may make the profit they expect while harming the people they claim to be serving. Long-term thinking gives way to short-term thinking, and selfish replaces selfless, sometimes even in the name of service, but it's service in name only. This new leadership priority rattles the very foundation upon which trust and cooperation are built. This has nothing to do with restricting a free market economy. This has to do with forgetting that people, living, breathing people, those who will play a greater role in our ability to innovate, make progress, and beat our competition, are now no longer viewed as our most valuable asset as we aim to compete with numbers. If anything, prioritizing performance over people undermines the free market economy. The better the products, services, and experiences a company is able to offer its customers, the more it can drive demand for those products, services, and experiences. And there is no better way to compete in a market economy than by creating more demand and having greater control over the supply, which all boils down to the will of those who work for us. Better products, services, and experiences are usually the result of the employees who invented, innovated, or supplied them. As soon as people are put second on the priority list, differentiation gives way to commoditization. And when that happens, innovation declines and the pressure to compete on things like price and other short-term strategies goes up. In fact, the more financial analysts who cover a company, the less innovative the company. According to a 2013 study that appeared in the Journal of Financial Economics, companies covered by a larger number of analysts file fewer patents than companies covered by fewer analysts. And the patents that those companies do generate tend to have lower impact. The evidence supports the idea that analysts exert too much pressure on managers to meet short-term goals, impeding firms' investment in long-term innovative projects. Put simply, the more pressure the leaders of a public company feel to meet the expectations of an outside constituency, the more likely they are to reduce their capacity for better products and services. When leaders eat first. Since the boomers took over the running of business and government, we have experienced three significant stock market crashes. One in 1987 that corrected for a period of excessive speculation and some argue an over-reliance on computer programs to make trades instead of people. One in 2000 after the burst of the dot-com bubble. And one in 2008 that followed the collapse of the overvalued housing market. Before 1987, there hadn't been a stock market crash since the Great Depression, which itself followed the excess and overvaluations of the 1920s. If we do not find ways to correct the imbalance ourselves, the laws of nature will always balance it for us. For a species born in a time when resources were limited and dangers were great, our natural inclination to share and cooperate is complicated when resources are plenty and outside dangers are few. When we have less, we tend to be more open to sharing what we have. A Bedouin tribe or a nomadic Mongolian family doesn't have much, yet they are happy to share because it is in their interest to do so. If you happen upon them in your travels, they will open up their homes and give you their food and hospitality. It's not just because they're nice people. It's because their survival depends on sharing. For they know that they may be the travelers in need of food or shelter another day. Ironically, the more we have, the bigger our fences, the more sophisticated our security to keep people away, and the less we want to share. Our desire for more, combined with our reduced physical interaction with the common folk, starts to create a disconnection or blindness to reality. Unfortunately, too many of the environments in which we work today do more to frustrate than to foster our natural inclinations to trust and cooperate. A new set of values and norms